So I just want to call the next set of panelists, please. So when you walked into this room, you were given some nice, wonderful pieces of paper. So what are these for? Okay, we are missing, where is Krishnan? I think he's gone out. Okay, where's Kishan? Okay. Has Kishan gone out? Okay, he was right here. Anyhow, so you have three pieces of paper. We have three sessions, and basically we're going to be we're actually going to look at three approaches. The first one will be focused on agriculture and water, energy, food nexus. The next one will be focused on coastal zones, marine ecosystems, and the other one is going to be resilient cities. So if you would like to react, you want to have a question or a contribution, et cetera, please, thank you, welcome. If it's agriculture,
yes, right, you raise your green card.
If it is coastal zones,
your blue card.
And if it is resilient cities, the yellow card. That way I will know that your question is directed to whom and when. So thank you so very much for joining us. We have Mr. Martin Frick from the FAO, and we have Mr. Krishnan from Trinidad and Tobago from the Ministry of Planning and Development, and also Laura Kavanagh from ICLE. Thank you so much. So if you can, within 3 to 5 minutes, just give us an idea in terms of, you know, how do you reckon that these, you know, this integration that we've been talking about is happening? Or if it's not happening, what seems to be the problem? Can I start with you, or perhaps shall I start with Martin, actually, in the middle? Please, thank you.
All right, thank you. 3 to 5 minutes for a story that actually started millions of years ago. The aim of my 3 to 5 minutes is to see as many green cards as possible after that and to enter into a discussion with you, because I'm very happy that this format is an interactive one. The nexus between food, water, and energy is as old as human civilization, and agriculture has always been the interface between human activity and natural resources. That's a very simple truth. We tend to forget this because we get our food out of supermarkets and we lost the touch of the production. But those people that, as the UN, we should be addressing most, the poorest, they haven't forgotten. Because the fact is that out of the 800 million people who are still hungry every single day on this planet, 80% are farmers. And you don't need to teach them about the relationship between food, energy, and water. 2 billion people on this planet are directly dependent on biomass as their only source of energy. So if you're looking into integrated solutions for adaptations, then you actually need to do two things. You need to combine the wisdom and the knowledge of many, many generations with cutting-edge technology. Let me give you 2-3 examples, and that should only be a discussion starter. One, for example, is agroforestry. A complicated word for simply combining trees and agriculture. People have always been doing that. But if you do it right, you can actually produce your own firewood. That is reducing pressure on forests. You can plant trees that are actually improving the soil quality, supporting the fertility of the soils and improving your food security. Trees have deeper roots than normal plants, and they are measured to retain water. And again, 200 years ago, I wouldn't have needed to say this, but it's something that we need to remind ourselves, and we need to remind the population that is now to more than 50% living in cities. Or rainwater harvesting has been around. There are some beautiful UNESCO World Cultural Heritage sites about rainwater harvesting. We need to reactivate these ways of harvesting water. But then how we deal with the water, we have to apply cutting-edge technologies such as drip irrigation or solar-powered drip irrigation that really brings the little energy that you need to the most remote areas. If we look at the very basis of farming, it's knowledge. And most of the world's poorest people would learn farming from their mothers and farmers. If you look at sub-Saharan Africa, more from the mothers than from the farmers. But simple facts such as when is the moment I bring out my crop in order to harvest some weeks later? Now, depending on rainfall pattern. Rainfall patterns are changing, and the traditional knowledge is not working anymore. So we need to bring accurate weather forecast to farmers. We need to bring the knowledge to farmers. And I was very happy to hear in the previous panel that several of the panelists said it's not the availability of data. We have more data than we ever had. But we need to bring them on the ground, and we have to translate them in a way that they make sense for their users. Ultimately, I think in all of this debate, 2 points I wanted to make, hope I still in my 3 to 4 minutes. One is that we look at adaptation as a local need, but successful adaptation in agriculture almost automatically brings mitigation benefits. So the benefit of adaptation on the ground is translating into a global benefit. And we need to recognize that and look at farmers not only as people who are squeezing productivity out of a piece of land in order to produce food to survive, but we need to see and we need to honor that these are stewards of our planet and that they are keeping our ecosystem intact, which we need, all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. I think you raise a really valid point in terms of the multi-benefits that these agrosystems also do provide, and the relevance and importance of, you know, food systems, etc., and all of that. I do understand that there might be some prepared interventions from the floors, from governments, in relation to this particular topic. Yes, please. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Lucy Ngaga. I'm from Kenya. And I think this discussion, we've had it quite a number of occasions in this session in Bonn. And like my colleague has pointed out, agroforestry is one of the ecosystems or one of the practices that really encompasses that ecosystem-based management, where the benefits are, you know, quite a number. I know he has outlined quite a number of them. But coming even from the context of Kenya, you see that even having to promote agroforestry in the farms, you know, reduces the pressure from the forests because the firewood is available right on the farm, the tree will be there, the firewood will be harvested. Of course, you'll have shrubs that will be integrated in the agroforestry that will feed livestock. And that, of course, will generate feed for livestock and incomes thereafter, and the cycle continues. And like he says, of course, you know, getting into adapting, the farmer's language is to adapt and be resilient. It's our discussions in these forums that we come out with the, you know, the words of mitigation, and mitigations are global benefits that you'll come count the trees and try to estimate how much carbon they have sequestered. That's our business here. The farmer business is to be resilient and to adapt and be able to be food secure, and, you know, their livelihoods are, you know, enhanced, and poverty eradication is, poverty is really reduced, if not eradicated for that matter. So coming from that point then, as a country, agroforestry is one of the activities that we take very seriously, because looking at adaptation vis-a-vis sustainable development goals, vis-a-vis, you know, interventions like the SEDAI framework for disaster risk, you know, reduction and risk reduction, you expect that there's a lot of synergy in that, because the expected outcomes and goals of a framework like the SEDAI framework is to build resilience, reduce losses, and reduce damage. Now, that resonates with the objective of the climate change resilience and adaptation to a sustainable development. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Was there another intervention? Gustavo, please, from Brazil.
Thank you. I just want to share a bit of our experience in Brazil. We there implemented a structured program for the agriculture sector called the ABC program. The fundamental idea there was to address issues related to climate change back into Copenhagen, and we were under the NAMA context, so we were dealing mitigation. in that context. And we started to implement that program with the idea that we should look at technology that will address three primary issues, three pillars that could sustain that technology so that we could communicate that to people on the ground. The first of one is productivity and how we maintain the level of income from people. The second one is resilience. How do we maintain over time the capability of food production on those systems? And the third one is the mitigation component, how to reduce emissions. But we have to implement that, and that's a big challenge because agricultural people don't really like to change their way they do things. But what we learn from this experience that we would have to communicate as best as possible using the best available information set that we had, that the benefits of implementing that technology would come over time, and that while doing the implementation, they will see multiple benefits. So looking ahead, the idea of how do we access people on the ground and producing the correct set of tools so that we can also allow them to talk with us, and that this communication process is a two-way around process that will also inform the policy making and decision making. This is a fundamental component. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much for that intervention. Quick question to you, Martin. I want you to react to the interventions, but also, since you're working in agriculture and also you're looking at this water energy nexus, do you think, because obviously the main theme of this particular technical expert management meeting is around the integration around these particular frameworks on adaptation, Sendai framework, DRR, and also the SDGs. Do you think this is something that's working in your sector, or how, if it's not working, what challenges do you seem to be, you know, posing that?
Well, thank you very much. I would even go beyond and say the sector is an example how it can work. Because if you look at the Sendai framework, if you want to reduce vulnerability, if you're looking at the interdependence of the 17 SDGs and the primary focus on 1 and 2, if you look at the Paris Agreement and the implementation on the NDCs, what you see is something that in a conference room looks fantastically complex and almost impossible to implement. However, if you go on a piece of land, if you look at landscapes, the interdependencies become obvious. If you have a mountain forest and people starting cutting down the mountain forest and you get downhill a little city, then you can just wait until there comes a moment when with heavy rainfalls and mudslides the city will be affected. Or in the long run, the water supply is actually depending from the hinterland of the city. So I think that the agricultural sectors are actually quite a good lens to look into the integration of these different issues. And given that food is such a basic human need, food security is actually a very good lens to combine these different sectors. And that's interesting because we had a series of discussions this week. We actually have a situation in which in different side events we spoke about win-wins and triple wins and I don't know how many wins, that this complexity of getting so many things right in one agenda actually makes it difficult to sell, because from the funding and from the support side, people have a tendency to look into specific perspective and say, give me a gender project, give me a rural empowerment project, give me a mitigation project, give me an adaptation project. And if you say, well, all of the above and more, then you might end up ultimately without funding. So that's one of the big issues.
Thank you. No, thank you for that reaction. And any reaction to the interventions off the floor? Okay, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Thank you. My name is Arif from Indonesia. Thank you for the introductions. Related to these three issues, food, water, and energy, this is a cross-cutting issues also. And there are, you mentioned about available data everywhere. But I think we should start with something in the government, whatever level, whether community level, whether district or city level or national level. So how can we accommodate this available data by introducing the indicator at national level or whatever level? So I think, do you have any example of this kind of indicators which integrating these issues, water, food, and energy, and in one location, in one government, cities, whatever? And then how can we use this as attracting tools, a platform, can invite all this available data to be integrated into the system? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I would like you to react to that fairly quickly because we'll move to the next speaker. And I want to just let everyone know in this room that at the end of the session, or at least at the end of the presentation from the panelists, we're going to have obviously Q&A, input, etc., and a very interactive session. And please, so keep your questions coming through Slido and also orally, of course. Your reaction, please.
Yes, a very short one. I don't know. And I think it's exactly what is needed is a platform in which we integrate. We have many fantastic pilots. I could bust this session just by giving you the examples of cell phone applications in many different countries, weather forecast, agricultural prices, connecting supply and demand. There are apps out there where you can take pictures of plant and the app tells you what disease the plant has and what household remedies you have. But until now, there is no unified platform in bringing that together. And I think it would be worthwhile an area to explore in a sense that it really invites as an open data platform universities, stakeholders from all ends to chip in. But I think it's a massive task and something that would be very promising.
Thank you so much. I think you end on a very good note in terms of also the importance and relevance of technology. And this is something perhaps we need to also start thinking about and perhaps we can bring back in our conversation later. I want to take this opportunity to also come now to the approach two, which is coastal and marine areas. Before we come to you, Kishan, we're going to have a video from a video message from Ronald Jackson, who couldn't be here, and he's from the Caribbean Disaster Emergency Management Agency.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I am very honored to be invited by the UNFCCC to join this expert panel looking at adaptation in particular. We have to have a focus on integrated planning and integrated resource management. And this is something that SEDIMA proposes within the context of its Comprehensive Disaster Management Strategy 2014 to 2024. We see disaster risk reduction as being central to the achievement of sustainable development and recognizing that the Caribbean is a coastally dependent community. What we are promoting is an integrated approach, looking at sectors in particular, especially the key economic sectors which are dependent on coastal resources and coastal assets. We see environment, climate change, and gender as a cross-cutting issue which has to be treated within that context. In considering this issue of trade-offs and opportunities, I think any reduction in watershed degradation and coastal area protection and settlement re-engineering over time will impact on traditional or currently unchecked practices within the Caribbean community. There are going to be some losers and some winners, and I think this has to be considered significantly as we frame these particular plans. We have to think through the opportunities very carefully, as well as the trade-offs that can be brought to bear in this regard. One such area that we're proposing is looking at the tourism sector and how we diversify more the tourism sector away from simply coastally dependent services, you know, the traditional sand, sun, and sea and coastal resources, but also to play up more of the community style tourism, the natural ecosystems upland, nature-based tourism, and so forth within the Caribbean context, which I think is still very largely unchecked. There is a dependency on huge infrastructure on the coastal zone. We may want to look more at softer approaches, as well as homes, community-style tourism, We're individuals that are more involved in housing tourists within the Caribbean space. Coastal zone and marine protection also to be looked at as an opportunity. We have Barbados as a very fascinating case as to how they've invested in coastal protection, but how that has contributed to greater investment in the tourism sector, greater socioeconomic activity, as well as, I would say, recreational activities being derived from this particular investment that improves resilience within the Barbados community. So I think that's an area we can look at. But when we also look at opportunities, we have to begin to look at creating a balance, a better balance from the climate change side between the investment in mitigation versus adaptation. As it stands now in the Caribbean, there's greater investment, I think, going into the area of mitigation in the form of energy security and energy sustainability. The threat for the Caribbean really is in the area of impact to our socioeconomic as well as environmental spaces. And so therefore, should we not be looking at changing the balance of this investment more towards adaptation rather than the heavy loading on mitigation in particular, recognizing that the greatest impact on the Caribbean is going to be on humanitarian, the people's security, their economy, their well-being, their lifestyles. And so therefore, we need to be looking at an opportunity there. This is being presented for investment. And the last, I think, is for the harmonization of all of these global framework so as to create a much more manageable space for implementation nationally. We have climate change, we have the Sustainable Development Goals, we have the Sendai Framework for Action, all of which I think are very important, but which needs to be appropriately harmonized and integrated more so into national development strategies to ensure greater success and efficiency in the use of investment resources. I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon.
Great. He sets the scene right there for you for the next segment. Kishan, please, your intervention, 5 minutes.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts on this issue. As you know, I'm intervening on the coastal and marine aspect of this, and I'm from Trinidad and Tobago, as you may know, which is a small island developing state in the Southern Caribbean. And depending on who you talk to, in fact, most people who you talk to would perhaps consider a small island state as an entire coastal zone, so that impacts on an entire sovereign country really reflects the impacts on the coastal zone and vice versa. So I'm here to perhaps give you a policy perspective on how adaptation has been approached, at least in Trinidad and Tobago, based on the vulnerability of the island and more specifically what it means for the coastal zone and the marine protected areas. Small island states are characterized by several constraints, small population, limited land mass, often competing land uses in various sectors. Most of these socioeconomic activities are located in coastal areas, purely coastal areas, because livelihoods are driven by coastal resources, fishing, and the do. But small island states are also continuously developing and in all sectors, which means that the development signal sometimes masks the climate change impact signal. So coping with climate change impacts and vulnerability sometimes become complicated if the signals cannot be adequately resolved. Therefore, adaptation responses and adaptation approaches must be, of course, carefully considered as a result. In Trinidad and Tobago, we have opted for an integrated approach to adaptation rather than a sort of project-by-project based approach. That does not mean, of course, that adaptation would be addressed solely in this way, but would, of course, by necessity, also involve projects in specific and discrete areas. So our national climate change policy, for example, alludes to addressing adaptation through an integration of adaptation considerations in sectoral policies. So that, for example, agricultural policy, coastal zone policy, health policies, developmental policies will all now integrate climate change considerations, climate change vulnerability and impacts into their policies, into their plans, into their programs, into their projects, while at the same time considering the nuances and the nexuses that impacts may have across sectors, and of course the water sector and the agricultural sector is perhaps the best known and the best readily acknowledged example. So it means then that when planning policies, when planning projects, when developing sectoral programs, nexuses would be taken into consideration. This way we think that climate change can truly be mainstreamed into international development. And in fact, our long-term development goal called Vision 2030 acknowledges this and alludes to incorporating the SDGs, for example. If you examine the SDGs, maybe 13 of the 17 goals do have nuances and relationships with climate change issues. Whether it be production and consumption, coastal zones, and in fact one of the standalone goals is indeed climate change. So the approach has been therefore to revise all the policies, revise all the sectoral legislation, legislative provisions to take into consideration climate change, the overarching climate change policy and impacts and adaptation options that may be identified. This is, of course, will go further to avoid maladaptation in any one sector, which may be also magnified because of cross interactions in other sectors. Building resilience, therefore, building climate resilience, international development has been the preferred approach, and we have seen that as well with the, as I said, the integration of the SDGs into the long term development plan for Trinidad and Tobago. It also speaks to building the resilience of existing structures, of existing natural ecosystems, for example, in the coastal zone, so that natural protection such as mangroves, the resilience, if the resilience is built and enhanced and protected and conserved, then man-made interventions could be minimized through seawalls, for example. And to do that, integrating projects and programs and policies for minimizing the impacts on these the stresses on these coastal zone and marine resources is also critical, so that minimizing waste, for example, developing policies for integrated coastal zone management, which will involve climate change considerations, is important. Protecting marine fisheries from pollution, land-based sources of pollution that will exacerbate climate change impacts is also important. So the approach has been and is to have a holistic, integrated, mainstreamed approach into national development, because we see climate change now as a national development issue, separate and apart from isolated impacts that may be gleaned from vulnerability studies that we also conduct in order to get a better sense of where the impacts are. I think the thinking has sort of graduated from the adaptation options that we had in the early 90s, late 80s, maybe of retreat from the coast. But when you live on a small island, you retreat from one coast, you end up in the other coast. And then where do you go? So the approach and the thinking has been revised, at least in our case, so that building resilience, building climate resilience, international development would we think redound in a more effective way to building climate adaptation, to identifying climate adaptation options, rather than project by project approaches. This, of course, also minimizes cost and also minimizes the cross-sectoral interactions. So that, I think, takes care of my 5 minutes. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Small Island, thank you. An applause, please. I keep forgetting that we really ought to applaud everyone on this panel after they've spoken. But you do raise a very valid point in terms of how small islands, literally, it's the entire example of a real landscape in terms, because you have forests, you have mountains, you have different ecosystems, agroecological systems, on the same space, and which is quite interesting. I do understand there might be an intervention for the floor from Chile, perhaps, or somebody. Yes, please, over there.
Yes, thank you very much. I would like to present some ideas following and building on top of what Kishan and the previous speaker were conveying. And maybe I would like to make a couple of comments on how we can integrate coastal protection, ocean conservation, in the context of the climate action that we are promoting from the convention. This is a point of view that we are trying to promote, since we believe that the ocean has not received enough attention from the discussions in the convention, and that is despite the fact that, as we have seen from these presentations, there is a very strong connection to climate change and the health of the ocean. And from that perspective, I think the ocean is an element that is cuts across all the whole climate action, both from the point of view of mitigation and the point of view of adaptation. As many of you would know, the ocean is one of the largest carbon sink in the planet, and however, it is not an unextinguishable carbon sink. It will extinguish at some point its capacity to capture CO2. It is a natural process, but has been deeply accelerated by the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. That has created many problems that we have seen now, like acidification and the lowering of the level of oxygen in the ocean, and that in turn has very serious problems in terms of how ecosystems are affected, and through the ecosystems and the biological and ecosystem services that the ocean provides, coastal communities, livelihoods, food security, and a number of other social and economic processes as well are suffering and under serious stress. The same thing could be applicable to jobs, for example. Kishan was giving us the example of how a small island state can be highly dependable on the activities that are related to the coast and to oceans. So that's something that we need to build, and we need to consider all those elements when we are building our own national policies in terms of resilience and being able to consider those that are mostly affected, which are at the same time probably the less capable of responding timely to this kind of of threats. But I wanted to raise one element that could enrich the discussion, which is the marine protected areas. Marine protected areas have been recognized as one of the most important policies or measures that you can take in conservating the ocean. And even though marine protected areas are more focused into conservation and ecosystem conservation, the marine protected areas can have a very important side event if you look them from the point of view of climate change. As I was mentioning before, climate change affects deeply the ecosystems in the ocean, and marine protected areas can really contribute to conserve those ecosystems and therefore alleviate the stress that the ocean is suffering in this regard. I just wanted to put an example from our own experience, which is the creation of the marine protected area of Nazca Desventuradas off the coast of Chile. It's 900 kilometers away off the coast of Chile, and is the largest marine protected area in the region. It's 300,000 square kilometers. this is very important because 72% of the species, the marine species in the island, are exclusive. This is the highest endemism found in the ocean. And a marine protected area, it is both a conservation measure, but at the same time, an adaptation policy. I just wanted to also mention that we are in the process of creating a marine protected area around Easter Island, which is under consideration and under consultation with indigenous people of Rapa Nui. And we are trying to promote this debate about how do we connect conservation measures like marine protected areas with climate change. And for example, just to mention the fourth International Marine Protected Areas Congress, or Impact 4, that will take place in Chile in September this year. This will be an opportunity to showcase these relations. And finally, I just wanted to mention that from the UNFCCC, it's very difficult to promote these kind of things, since we are very much oriented into negotiations, and somehow negotiations are happened in a place that is somehow, you know, away from these very concrete things that are happening at the root level. But however, we have tried to promote this awareness, and this is why we have promoted a declaration that's been signed by 26 countries that is called Because the Ocean, and we are trying to promote precisely the connection between ocean conservation and the formulation of NDCs. If we don't include the ocean conservation, coastal ecosystem conservation in our NDCs, it will be very difficult to make this match. And therefore, we are encouraging parties of the convention to include this perspective in their NDCs, so the synergies and the co-benefits can be identified and enhanced.
Thank you very much, Julio. Was there another intervention from FAO? FAO, please.
Yes,
good afternoon. You can introduce yourself, please, sir.
My name is Stefan Baas. I'm working in the resilience management team in FAO and give this intervention on behalf of my colleagues from the fisheries department, which cannot be here today. Martin has reminded us in his intervention that about more than 2 billion people depend on agriculture, heavily impacted by the impacts of climate change and extreme events. Out of those 2.4 billion people, around 800 million people depend to make their livelihoods on fisheries. The topic of coastal zone management is a good reminder for all of us to think about breaking the figures down into the target groups for whom we are working. And the figures of 800 million people really speak on itself to underline how important coastal zone management as well as river basin management is from a fisheries perspective, but I think also from an environmental perspective, because these provide the environmental services for all of us. And putting in that context the statement of my colleagues, climate change, variability, and extreme weather events already affect and change the industries of fisheries and aquaculture, and therefore affect food security and livelihoods, with major impacts expected to increase, particularly in the poorest countries and for the poorest populations. It has been increasingly recognized that reducing the vulnerability of fishing communities as a whole can help address poverty and resource degradation and enhance adaptive capacity to a range of shocks, including those resulting from climate variability and extreme events. Options to increase resilience and adaptability in the context of coastal zone management include the adoption as a standard practice of adaptive and precautionary management within an ecosystem approach to fisheries and an ecosystem approach to aquaculture. The ecosystem approach to fisheries and aquaculture are not completely new strategies. They pull together existing instruments and agreements, stressing holistic, integrated, and participatory processes on the basis of operations. The key features of the ecosystem approaches to fisheries and aquaculture are first maintaining ecosystem integrity, while second improving human well-being and equity, and third promoting and enabling governance, all aspects which have been discussed in this meeting today several times. Moreover, the fisheries and aquaculture sector needs to be blended into national climate change adaptation and disaster risk reduction strategies, and vice versa. Also, climate change and disaster risk reduction needs to be more prominent in fisheries and aquaculture sectoral development strategies. So that needs to be mutually reinforcing and consistent. Without careful planning and integrated approaches, aquatic ecosystems, fisheries and aquaculture can potentially suffer as a result of adaptation measures applied by other sectors, such as increased use of dams, hydropower in catchments with high rainfall, construction of artificial coastal defenses, or marine wind farms. Again, some thoughts which underline the importance of landscape approaches we have to look at. To build the resilience to the effects of climate change and derive sustainable benefits, fisheries and aquaculture managers need to adopt and adhere to the best practices for coastal zone management, such as those described in the FAO Code of Conduct for Responsible Fisheries. These practices need to be integrated more effectively with the management of river basins, watersheds, and coastal zones. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that intervention. I think we'll move swiftly to the last but not the least presenter, Laura Kavanagh from ICLEI, who will talk about resilient cities, and also for you to give us a perspective in terms of, you know, how is the integration happening, you know, what seem to be the challenges and opportunities perhaps, and sort of in line with what this particular TEME is all about. Please, over to you.
So I was really excited to be invited to be part of this discussion because we just posed the same question to our network and to our partners in cities and local governments we work with last week at our Resilient Cities Congress, and to ourselves as well as an organization bringing these groups together. To now, because we've been so focused on the negotiations and the role and getting local governments and authorities recognized, and this coherence in the text, now it's really time to move to the implementation in an integrated way. And several of the 2020 goals relate specifically to local governments. The 2020 goal in Sendai framework, Target E, is calling for those local level plans. The so-called urban sustainability goals, SDG 11, the 2020 goal there is also specifically relating to these integrated plans referring both to adaptation and disaster risk reduction and sustainable development. So first, we really had to sort of stop and think, well, where are we? And what is sort of the baseline and how integrated are our actions at the local level. And anecdotally, we've seen some very positive examples, but ahead of our discussion last week, we wanted to do a little bit more of a preliminary analysis anyway of some of the data that we've collected over the past 5 years. So we have been collecting data via our Carbon Climate Registry, and this is an open portal where local governments and subnational governments can report their climate adaptation and mitigation actions. And we've sort of been passively collecting this information on adaptation actions and adaptation plans since 2010. And we thought, well, let's take a look, let's do a first assessment of how these adaptation actions are aligning with SDG 11 Target B. So this is the 2020 target. And this one is calling for to substantially increase the adoption and implementation of policies and plans that are inclusive, that are resource efficient, that have mitigation adaptation to climate change, and that apply holistic disaster risk management at multiple levels in line with the Sendai framework. So it's a very minor first step for our target for SDG 11. But we wanted to see at sort of a high level, since there's also no specific agreed definitions exactly on these different terms, but at a high level, how well these different actions and plans held up to these different pieces in this target. So we looked at 242 completed actions that had been reported and 25 adaptation plans by 132 different subnational governments from 35 countries. So a decent sample that we had to work with as the first look. And the results were pretty promising in a way. We found that about a quarter of the actions and almost all of the plans addressed all four of those aspects in some way. and that two-thirds of the actions were at least partially. They were addressing two or three, inclusive, resource-efficient, mitigation and adaptation, and disaster risk management. We found that three-quarters of the actions broadly aligned with the Paris Agreement goals, and about 38% aligned at a high level with the Sendai framework. And all of the plans aligned with all 25 of those plans broadly aligned with Paris and Sendai framework. So this was a good start. Much more analysis needs to be done, much more work needs to be done, but it showed that there's already some significant progress. It wasn't just sort of anecdotal evidence. We could really start to see some numbers on this. Of course, it's a bit of a biased sample. These are local governments who are reporting to a sustainability platform. Many of them are signed up to these global level commitments already or have already committed to these types of networks like ICLEI, so something to keep in mind. But in our discussions at our Resilient Cities Congress, we brought this up, and one of the key messages that was coming through to really summarize 3 days of discussions is that the progress is being made in this respect because integration is practical. When these integrated approaches are really happening because they're necessary to be successful. If you want to be successful at adaptation, you need to bring in the disaster risk elements and the eco-resource efficiency elements and make it inclusive. And sometimes it takes really this push to kind of force these multi-sectoral, multi-stakeholder collaborative approaches and a bit of a challenge to help us tap into our more creative natures and competitive natures, and this is where the global goals and agreements can really help. We heard, for example, from Guimarães in Portugal, they have this roadmap to a sustainable city, and they were saying this was really made possible that they could start this process because they linked their local project to the global level goals. But at the same time, they were also responding, especially on the adaptation side, to the local necessity. The mayor had residents demanding that they address the flooding problems. So these global goals gave them a framework to see how they could be more integrated in their approaches, but there was still this local necessity. And that's still what we're seeing many of these, at the local level, many of these actions are being started in response to a disaster, to demand, more bottom-up than top-down. And they've found, the cities that have gone through these different adaptation and resilience plans, that it really requires those collaborative approaches to be effective. And it's also much easier to implement these policies when you have the buy-in, of course, from the communities and the private sector, as we've heard. So it takes time to really build that trust and that awareness. And when you have these collaborative planning processes, then these result in more collaborative, multi-sectoral, integrated actions because you're now accountable to that range of stakeholders that were involved in the planning process. And you're more likely to have interventions with these co-benefits that are more integrated and more attractive to this range of stakeholders. And just one, to pick one sort of outcome of our discussions, this has also been said several times today. It's not that we need more information, it's that we need to curate and manage the information and the knowledge and the tools that we have. And to quote our director of our U.S. office, information does not replace assistance. This is really where the local governments are looking for more support, and this is where our local research partners, our NGOs, civil societies can come in more strongly, especially to help with that future scenario planning, and as opposed to the sort of responding to historical trends and disasters, but looking at what's going to be happening. And sort of an ask that we have really coordinated support is very important, that we're not coming to these local governments, as happens frequently, with SDG indicators and Sendai indicators and Paris Agreement indicators, but that we're really approaching them in a coordinated manner to support what their needs are.
Thank you very much, Laura. I was just listening to you and also hearing the outcomes of the meeting that you had. I hear two things. I mean, the key message that came out in terms of, you know, progress has been made, that's true, but integration is practical. That's a really valid point. And also, information does not replace assistance. I think it's a critical take-home message. I just want to say now I'm going to open up the session, and I really want this to be interactive. And for those of you who want to come even closer to the inner circle, please you move, because it's going to be an exciting session. Now, there are a lot of questions coming through Slido, and I will pick some questions, but please, you're welcome to raise yellow, green, or blue, and say, you know, in terms of an intervention. So let me just pick a couple of questions, and they'll be open to
anyone on the panel can actually respond to that. First question is coming from, it says anonymous. No, actually, it's coming from, if I can pronounce your name correctly, Mireya Loria. What could be done to raise awareness on climate change in education across all disciplines? So I suppose it's in relation to, you know, if we're going to be doing integration, is our educational system actually ready? Or is it capable? The people that are coming out of universities, the people that are coming out of, you know, because clearly listening to you, Martin, and also to yourself, Kishan, you do mention that we tend to think in silos, really. We have thought in silos for years. Let me start with you, Martin, and then perhaps anyone from the panel, please.
Maybe let me briefly start as in my quality as a father of three little children. I'm German, as you can say, from my accent. In the 1970s, all of the environmental movement that is still strong in this country really started also in the education system. And it was not rarely that the children actually educated their parents. And it was not so much to telling the children what to do. I think children get climate change and they understand it and they look at things and understand immediately what works and doesn't work. I think if we can mobilize children to actually educate their parents, then we are up to something that could really help.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. I think education, like other biophysical and economical, socioeconomic sectors, also has to adapt with the sort of information requirements and the education requirements now that is required under climate change. So one of the ways, of course, is integrating in the formal education system at the earliest level and to the highest level. There are already, programs at university level that speak adequately to some of these issues in climate change. But more than just formalizing education material, I think translating that education into a sort of practitioner's application is critical. So the pool of knowledge by itself is while it's useful, is not useful enough unless the application of that knowledge can be demonstrated or can be applied or some sort of demonstration of the application of that knowledge be formalized as well. So I think that the formal education system and the practitioner side as well needs to have some bridging so that you can have lessons learned and shared. Because you have these primary impacts, you have the secondary impacts, you have the tertiary impacts, you have the indirect impacts, across sectors. So getting a holistic picture of climate change would be necessary and not perhaps stuck in the context of any one discipline.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Laura?
I would sort of build on that and say the same thing. Because integrated approaches are practical, the curriculums also need to get practical. And we're seeing a real call from both sides, from researchers and from local governments, to have these local pairings. Then you're also building the local knowledge both ways. So you're developing these programs where the researchers can help answer a question that the local authorities have for their sustainable planning, and that will be cross-cutting if this is designed properly. Most likely they will have to respond with multiple departments and get multiple people involved and also hear from the cities on what this looks like for them, what they need, so you have that exchange of information going both ways. And you're educating the urban planners and the policymakers as well, that we need to build their capacity, but at the same time we're showing the students, the professors, the department's heads what's really needed and helping them work together within the departments in the cities and within the departments within the universities to co-create this knowledge.
Thank you. So we need adaptable education, clearly. That's fit for purpose. There is a question at the back there. The gentleman, please introduce yourself. It's a question directed to you, Kishan, because I saw the blue card. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Espen Ronneberg, climate change advisor with the Secretariat of the Pacific Regional Environment Program based in Samoa. It's not so much of a question, really, but a comment on what Kishan said. Kishan, of course, is an example of some of the very clever people that we have in SIDS. We have a few in the Pacific as well who have been working on developing a curriculum that actually incorporates climate change from preschool up to pre-college. And it's incorporated in such a way that it's actually that it can be utilized for lessons in every single subject matter, in mathematics, in English, in geography, in history. And it hasn't been rolled out yet, but we see great potential in this because you'd give a practical example of a climate change thing, climate change impact in a mathematics class. It can have a powerful message. So I'm hoping that we will be able to roll this out, and 20 years from now, maybe we'll see the results.
How exciting. Clearly, there's a lot of things that are emerging. You want to react to that, Martin?
Just very briefly, one of the things we want our children to understand is what good nutrition looks like and how it affects your own health and your own body. And I might just say, if you actually do nutrition right, you're almost automatically choosing products and choosing a diet, which is also good for the climate. So there's also an interdependence there.
Brilliant. Fantastic. The lady in the middle at the back there, please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Renske Peters from the Education Committee. Well, when you're talking about education and disciplines, I like to give some attention to the design disciplines, because I think by design you can illustrate and translate what integration means. So my play is also to use also these disciplines in, well, an integrated approach. You can get more innovative solutions, but also you get engagement of people because you illustrate it. That's what I want to add on this point. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. The lady in the middle, a question for the cities, to Laura.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really pleased to be here. My name is Daphne Frank from the German International Corporation, GIZ. And it's more a comment than a question. I also would like to highlight the role of the cities. More than 70% of the SDGs will be implemented in cities, according to a study. It's not only the goal 11, it's more than that. And so we need to strengthen the cities in their role to plan and manage and to become more resilient. And I only would like to share one experience from a global project called Cities Fit for Climate Change. So our approach is to look what already exists at the local level, what kind of plans and strategies, like land use plans, like urban development strategies, and we try to improve these existing strategies and not develop an extra plan and so on. And from the very first start, we try to work on an integrated urban development approach, bringing different kind of sectors together. Because when you work in cities, and cities need to decide on their own territory, there at the end need to bring together all the sectors, the transport, the health, disaster risk management, and so on. So there is no other way than to work on an integrated urban development approach. Thank you very
much. Thank you very much, Daphne, for that intervention. Before I move to you, I'll just look at another question on the screen, and we'll come back to you. I will not forget about you. I think there's a very interesting question in the middle, which really is for everyone here on the panel and perhaps even people in the audience. Given the benefits of integrating adaptation, SDGs, and DRR agendas, how do we manage the tensions and, tensions around international finance for new and additional adaptation? Are there tensions?
We don't. I wanted to counter a bit, actually, the video on this point, because it's not an and-or situation. These funds are addressing simultaneously mitigation, adaptation, disaster risk reduction, so we should rather be developing these interventions in a way that they're addressing all of these, and we're using the money more efficiently to do that, so it's not creating that competition. I think this is going back a bit to where we weren't even supposed to talk about adaptation, because now we're competing for mitigation. So I think this is the wrong way to frame it. Mm-hmm. And I can give an example of how some cities have also been sort of changing the rules. We're talking about regulations and at the local level in the societies discussion earlier today. And we've seen that when, for example, in Copenhagen, where they came up against this, they have siloed funding. So they had funding for sewer improvements, but they did this very integrated ecosystem-based, community-based adaptation approach for their cloudburst management plan to manage flooding. And it didn't really qualify, but it was addressing these same things. So they changed the rule. They lobbied to change the legislation so they could tap into this kind of siloed fund to use it for this integrated approach, which, of course, addressed the same type of stormwater concerns that the traditional piping approach would have that they have now moved away from. So it's those types of rethinking, reframing, and changing our types of regulations that are needed.
Okay. Martin?
I'm just referring back to what Amina Mohammed has said, I think, 2 days ago. I know it was on Saturday and Sunday morning here in the plenary. It really comes down to national planning. The new financing instruments, such as the Green Climate Fund, have one prerogative, and this is it needs to be country-driven. It is really something that responds to what countries want to have financed. And what we need to manage is in the member states to really get the different communities, the Sendai community, the SDG community, the people who are here on the board, together for an integrated planning approach. And that's really demanding. I mean, one of the key things that I see in my daily work is while you have agriculture mentioned in so many of the NDCs, if you look closer, so ever so often the agriculture community was not part of this planning exercise. So I think what we need to do is really on a national level to bring these different plans together to make it simple, to make it understandable, and then it can translate into financing proposals which are not conflicting but really working for a comprehensive agenda.
And are complementary.
Yes.
Great. Kishan, do you have a reaction to that?
Just briefly, to perhaps build on that, climate finance has always been, is, and perhaps will always be, a topical issue that perhaps has been categorized as having tensions in the national negotiations. But that's perhaps just the nature of the beast. So I wouldn't address how those could be diffused. What I could say, though, is that having recognized that the benefits of integrating adaptation, what needs to now be developed, at least from a country-driven approach, is to how do you get more bang for the buck so that the issue of new and additional adaptation, whatever that means, can be reconciled in the context of integration across all of these areas and as well in the context of national development.
Thank you very much. There was a gentleman at the back who had a question for Coastal. Please, if you can introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Ali from the Maldives. Yeah, I see my good friend Kishan. Well, Maldives, you know, small islands where we get the highest point is somewhere around 5 meters above the mean sea level, so which is really low lying. And then just, well, not a question, but to provide my insight from some of the experience that we had at home, from one of the projects that we had from Jeff on tourism adaptation, since we are talking about the coastal communities here. I happened to be one of the surveyors who was within one of the activities of the project, and we were looking at how the investors or the tourism managers understood the climate change, the adaptation, mitigation, you know, all these jargons that we have here and relating to the investments that they have. Surprisingly, it was quite a low number of them. The investors, be it the managers at the managerial level, they don't understand what this climate change and adaptation and what are the risks to their investments. So from that, actually, we came to know that there's quite a poor awareness within the private sector. I mean, I can speak of the Maldives, not elsewhere. So there's a poor awareness regarding the climate change aspects within the private sector. And then those who happen to know about the impacts of the climate change, we ask about, okay, what are the measures that you guys are taking to tackle the impacts of climate change? And one of the interesting things which came was regarding the insurance schemes. So then we went further down and asked them, so what are the risks that's been covered in your insurance schemes? And surprisingly, I mean, even if you ask me what's covered in my health insurance, I wouldn't know what's covered in there. So the same, I mean, they wasn't aware what were the kind of the risks which would be covered within their insurance scheme, whether that's natural disasters, whether climate-related disasters. So actually, the whole thing boiled down to the poor awareness. And since we are, again, talking about the coastal communities here, especially in the tourism sector within Maldives, it's a common resource shared by the tourism sector and the communities for their livelihood as well, especially for fisheries. The fisheries, the reef systems, that is used as a commodity within the tourism sector. But as soon as we define the boundary of the tourist resorts, that boundary or the areas which was used for the livelihoods of the communities is lost. So where do we address the loss to the community but the gain to the tourism industry? So we have been, we actually went far asking, how do you guys tackle through this? But coming from the government, through the tourism various policies, the investors who do the investment has to go through their corporate social responsibility to pay something to the community, because that's a big loss to the community once we define the whole boundary for the tourism industry. But apparently, even though they have to make their corporate social responsibility, we find that it's not properly done. In some of the resorts, of course, they help the communities, but in others, they don't. So that shows that there is quite a bit of lack of enforcement by the government within the governments to enforce the various policies. And then just coming back to what is related to the previous session that we were talking about, the availability of data and the complexity of the data. And relate that to the planning. We see that, okay, these resorts, when it comes to this coastal infrastructure, that's huge amount of investment going down to it. Maybe something around of the order of 70 to 100,000 million dollars going into it. And then one of the areas that, I mean, we came to find out was when they come through the investments, I mean, for the investments, how much screening do you guys do for your investments to come in? For the climate risk assessment, do you guys really go through this? Well, they say they have to go through this because when they seek the money to come in for the investment, they have to go through major banks. Mm-hmm. So when going through the major banks, of course, they have their very rigid screening procedures. So that's why one of the areas they do the climate. But when it comes to the local planning, the only part, I mean, in Maldives, the only part they touch on this is just the environmental impact assessments. Right. But on the environmental impact assessments as well, no climate risk is there, really. So it's very poor. And the other drawback is, from the investor's point of view, they say that the data available and the source, the information out there relating to climate change is so complex.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that intervention. I think we're really getting a sense in terms of how the private sector, perhaps, you know, it just really demonstrates to some extent, in fact, not to some, to a quite a large extent, in terms of how do we communicate. I think you do raise a valid point that obviously they're also busy, you know, private sector are busy doing things and they can't afford to have time to come and sit in some of these discussions. But also there's the flip side in terms of what sort of information, how are we packaging this information and sharing with the private sector? And perhaps maybe food for thought. Is this something that we should be feeding into the conversation around the Global Center of Excellence for Climate Adaptation? Is that a potential platform that can be used?
we need to think about it. Is there any other question? I see you holding two cards, but both green and yellow? Okay, if you can introduce yourself, please.
Indeed, it is for two persons. My name is Frederick. I'm with the French delegation working on adaptation. I have a question for our colleagues from FAO and ICLE. Colleague from FAO, you said the more you go down to the project level, the easier it is to actually merge the Sendai adaptation SDG element. One question there, how do you do it? Same question to ICLE, because you said when you're going to the communities, you can actually not go there with indicators from the three different frameworks. You're doing this in a more coherent approach. So what is that coherent approach? I'm just trying to understand how you actually manage to merge those three.
Can we take another question? Can we take another question from the floor, and then perhaps we can have final reactions, because we're almost close. Over to you, please, if you can introduce yourself, ma'am.
Thank you. I have a question to ICLE related with the sustainability of good initiative that already introduced to the local cities. I mean, when you introduce good practices, how they can maintain, as we know that the local leader only there for 5 years and until then, and then change with another person perhaps. So maybe we should also think about the sustainability of good practices that already introduced. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll pose a third question to you, Laura, because there's another one from Louise through Slido, which is actually saying, shall adaptation in cities come from a bottom-up approach made by citizens more than a top-down approach in order to really meet the needs of the habitants? So I think we can start with you, Martin, and then we can move over to Laura to address the final questions. That's all right.
Yeah, thank you. I just regret that Lucy Nganga, who asked the question from Kenya, has gone, because in a different side event, she actually alluded to that. If you're looking at the different frameworks and you're talking to a farmer, it comes together in a point that this person needs to survive, needs to make sure that there's enough food and that the system is not being degraded by being used. So what are the areas that are interesting for a farmer? If there's a heavy rainfall, then it washes away the soils. If you address the soils being washed away by simple terracing, you can prevent that. That's a disaster risk reduction measure because you prevent mudslides. It is an adaptation measure because it retains the water in the soil. It's a mitigation measure because it keeps soil organic carbon in the soil at the same place. The farmer doing that is actually doing that to keep his or her livelihood in place. I'm always saying a farmer is not coming out on Monday and saying, today I'm doing disaster risk reduction, and on Tuesday this is my mitigation day, Wednesday is food security day, and Thursday is adaptation day. It's the same piece of work. And so this is where I mean that the different aspects of the work that make sense in all these different perspectives are really coming together in very simple things that you can do on the ground. I don't know whether this is satisfactory, but we can take that offline. I'm happy to give you a couple of more examples. But I think it went to you as well.
Mm-hmm. So I can maybe sort of thread some of these together. So in terms of how to merge the approach locally, I think it comes down to that bottom-up. You need to meet the needs of the communities and what the risks and priorities are when you're doing those risk assessments, or when you, if you haven't done a risk assessment and a disaster strikes, and then you have to react rather than prepare, plan. So another example would be from Accra. So in 2015, they had... Previously, their national disaster management agency, which was working with the local governments, was more traditional. They were kind of fire and emergency response. But then in 2015, they had a series of floods, which then triggered fires, and then they had cholera outbreaks. And this is what happens at the local level. You can't just put out the fire. You can't even get to it because there's a flood and the hospitals are overrun. So by responding to those bottom-up needs, it becomes default sort of merged. And what they ended up doing, so they saw that they needed to take a different approach. So they first worked with the World Bank, City Strength Diagnosis, and through this partnership, they were able to apply this broader lens. So it was taking these kind of global approaches that had been considered in this tool with this diagnostic to help this disaster management agency sort of take that broader look at how they were approaching their policies. And they ended up changing their mandate to include climate risks and also changing some of the rules that they did. So they included a requirement that 3% of transfers from the national level to the local level had to go towards disaster risk management, including climate risks. So that's an example of how these things can come together in response to what the real needs are on the ground. Urban gardening and food is another real example where these things come together, but I think we've heard some of those pieces. And in response to the question here about sort of the good practices and maintaining and changing of administrations, and this is a constant discussion point amongst local governments, amongst our network, and it's something that's always there that they need to sort of address, but there's different ways that they've been able to approach it. So one way is making sure you have the buy-in of the communities. If the community is demanding these changes, then no matter who's in charge, they're going to get the same requests and they're going to want to continue whatever plans have been put in place. And that can also help if for example, the mayor of Kalimani in Mozambique was describing a process where they had a budget that they couldn't get support from at the national level, and so then they ended up having a march, and they got that grassroots support, and that kind of forced through some of the political blockade that this was facing, so it can also help in that respect as well. Another part of that is investing in these longer-term plans, so you're having these interventions that are sort of going beyond and across administrations. They're not short-term, and they're already sort of in motion, and you have investments in other players in place from the private sector, from your local government planners who will stay there across administrations, so you have that momentum. And the third piece is really investing in that local capacity and in those exchanges. So that's a way to also maintain these interventions and to learn and to pass on these good practices, because as we all know, this is a process. It's not a destination. And a lot of this has been very experimental. It's trial and error. We're learning more and more every day about the actual impacts. Things are changing from models even a few years ago. So connecting the cities to each other so they can share is really helping to accelerate and build on those best practices. And sharing your mistakes as well is very important, so you can avoid making those same mistakes elsewhere.
Thank you very much. The lady over there in the middle, please, if you can introduce yourself and the question.
Hi, I'm Sophia from Yungo, and my question is for Martin. So earlier you mentioned the fact that the basis of agriculture is knowledge, and we know that in many communities traditional knowledge is very important. So I wanted to ask you, how are you planning to bring knowledge to those communities? Yeah, that's thank you.
Okay. Well, I think it's two questions. It's how you bring the modern knowledge to the communities, but at the same time listen what they have to say and transport the traditional knowledge up. There's a very vibrant community around Article 6 of the Convention that's working on education with fantastic side events, and I can only recommend you join this network, because there are fantastic experiences around. I think that where it really comes together, and the other gentleman who asked the question has left, unfortunately, but we have only started to understand what digital inclusion actually can do here. We have a network coverage on the African subcontinent of about 95%. In the most remote areas, at least you have GSM mobile, you have very often third, even fourth generation mobile. And used smartphones are becoming really, really affordable. What we don't have, because it hasn't been discovered as a promising group of people as customers, is ways to communicate. We need to resolve many different languages, for example, to get this knowledge together. There are examples which are quite fascinating. I could talk all night about this, but I'm short. In Mali, for example, there is national radio where farmers are, with text messaging, sending to the radio station just a simple weather report. So today was a rainy day, we had X amount of precipitation and cloudy sky. And in the evening, the moderator of a show is just for half an hour reading out what people were texting in. Now, if you're in a village and you know that the wind is coming from the west and the three neighboring villages have already rain, well, the odds are that tomorrow you will have rain as well. So people are genius and ingenious in sharing information. We need to bring that to the next level in two ways. And that's also a big piece of South-South learning. If you have the climatic conditions in one area being today as they were in another area 15 years ago, there's something you can learn from the people from that region. How we exactly do it, I don't know, but I think there's an enormous community out there with creative ideas of how to harness these new digital possibilities, which we need to tap into.
Thank you very much. Kishan, did you have a comment on that? Any other question from the floor? Did I miss somebody? Perhaps some people sitting at the back? Shall I take a question from Slido? Since we'll actually be moving pretty soon to the wrap-up session, there was a question that was asked. How shall we incorporate biological diversity in agriculture and forestry in order to build resilience? And you may have answered part of it already.
I have a simple answer to that. If we are not, we are just simply doomed. I mean, we understand that in our nutrition, if you look just at a root of one plant, there are literally millions of microorganisms who are just helping this one plant to grow. We need to bring... we need to bring in biodiversity. That's nonsense. We wouldn't have food without biodiversity. But what we need to bring in is an understanding that if you leave 10% of your land unused, if you leave it for bushes, for forests, for there was a question also about the connection of forests, for a coherent corridor for wildlife, that this ultimately is benefiting you. And that producing more and more land is not automatically a sustainable answer, because then you're not doing agriculture, you're actually doing mining. So biodiversity, yes, of course, we have the land, we share this land with other organisms, and if we claim 100% for ourselves, it falls 100% on our feet.
Great. Before we actually come to the wrap-up session, because I'll do a final wrap-up, there's one question that's just popped up, which I think is also quite valid. It sounds that there are no trade-offs in meeting the targets. However, the real world seems to give somehow a different answer. Is that the sense? Is that the feeling? Can I start with you, Kishan? Would you have any reaction to that?
Not targeted reaction, but I think it's not a linear path towards these targets. And so along the way, there would invariably be circumstances that would present themselves, because it's a long-term approach. That would require consideration of trade-offs, whether those are economic trade-offs, whether they are developmental trade-offs, whether trade-offs related to food security, for example. Depending on your circumstances or what is important for your development, I think that would have to be considered at that time. But to second guess what those trade-offs would be could be perhaps a little bit risky, because then you would not be able to quantify what they would exactly be at that time when they're required.
Martin?
There are always trade-offs. I think if you're speaking about food, what I'm trying to get across is the point that if we are paying farmers fairly, if we are paying them also for keeping the ecosystem intact, then, of course, food will be a little bit more expensive. Or if we funnel climate finance into smallholder farmers, of course there are taxpayers somewhere who have to pay for this climate finance. But as you would pay for a national park, as it's a recreational area, as it's part of your national identity, I think on a global scale we are well advised to pay for the life support system that we have. So I wouldn't consider that a trade-off.
Thank you. Laura?
Yes, of course, there's so much unpredictability in environmental systems, human systems, you don't know what's going to happen. Maybe you have the best of intentions with a town meeting and the priority goes in a completely different direction than what your science is even telling you for some reason out of your control. So this is never perfect. But I think it's also really good to have these conversations because it can sometimes head off some of those maybe maladaptation processes, or at least we're considering where those trade-offs would be and better able to prioritize in advance than to react. For example, when you're trying to choose between efficiency with energy systems and emissions from a mitigation standpoint and redundancy from a adaptation and resilience standpoint, these are really valid questions. There's not necessarily right answers, but you need to look at the local context and really make an informed decision.
I do have another question here that's come from N. I don't know if that is the initial of the individual, however, it is N. van der Berg. What are proposed strategies to increase transnational connectivity between forests? And that could be maybe in an island setting, perhaps, or in an usual landscape setting, or even in a city context, cities that have forests. Martin, perhaps you could start.
I sort of alluded to this question in my answer before, that from a biodiversity standpoint, you need to have coherent systems in which wildlife can roam. Indeed. And that's something that we would advocate for, that we would make part of national agriculture structures, also with the argument I just used that in the end, it actually keeps the land more productive and ensures the water supply. And you need these coherent areas of forests because otherwise you're jeopardizing a big piece of biodiversity. So I take that, I hope I understood it correctly, but I take it more as a biodiversity, as a climate question, while there are climate ramifications, of course.
Indeed. Would you have a reaction to that, Kishan?
Well, it speaks to transnational, but I suppose I can maybe give it a context of continuity and connectivity. So maybe one strategy would be to minimize fragmentation, habitat fragmentation, in your development plans. So that, for example, a road that might be necessary that needs to pass through a forest reserve or another forested area should be designed where you don't have fragmentation, or you have minimum fragmentation, or that connectivity is maintained in some way, either through tunnels at the bottom or some other means. So I think it's all about knowing what the impacts of your project is going to be, your developmental project, but also recognizing the importance of keeping that continuity and that connectivity, because it impacts on the ecosystem services that forests and its associated wildlife can offer.
Great. Thank you. Would you have a reaction?
Sure. Just that with these sort of big questions, it's also, I think, helpful to sometimes break it down and know that we can take stepwise approaches, because if we have this principle of connectivity and green corridors at the local levels up to the national level, then you have them in place to connect. So it doesn't always have to come from a big international effort to connect a forest. You can start locally in your cities and communities with green corridors and then start connecting those upwards. So depending on where you are, there's different approaches to achieve the same goal.
Okay. Thank you. There is one last question, since we're just about to come to the wrap-up session at 4:15. There's a question that's just popped in terms of, I mean, obviously, in the end, we really want to improve the livelihoods of poor people. So what strategies in terms of, you know, raising awareness and also really communicating to larger population that are very poor, who just do not even think climate change would be a priority to them? And this is an anonymous question. What strategy would we use? What would be perhaps, maybe I could rephrase that if the anonymous individual allows. I mean, perhaps what's the entry point for them to know that they need to be resilient? Or we're working towards them being resilient. Laura, we'll start from your end.
In many of our local government experiences, they don't need to raise the public awareness because it is there. Those poor communities are the ones that are the most vulnerable. They are the ones that are experiencing it. They're literally on the front line, on the coast. They know more, in many cases, than the local officials do. And when the local officials go in to raise awareness, they end up learning more. And by doing these participatory approaches, there really is this two-way exchange. And it's true that they might not be discussing it in sort of climate change terminology, but they're aware of their flooding risks and these other things that are impacting them and how these have changed and need to be brought into the conversation in an inclusive way, being aware of the language. But I would say that in many cases, the awareness is there, if not, if even if it's not called climate change adaptation. Martin?
I would absolutely endorse that and add on to this that, as I said at the outset, 80% of these poorest people on this planet actually are smallholder farmers. So that is what makes the agriculture topic so extremely difficult, because you're dealing with so, so many stakeholders. And so the question of the awareness, I would turn it around in saying, how can you make people aware that, you know, they need a cooperative approach? There is money available. How do you tap into this money? How do you get the knowledge and the technology that is existent? So how do you organize people? That starts with very simple questions, or well, complicated questions actually, like land tenure. Who belongs the land you are working on? Are you entitled to this? Are you aware that there are international guidelines, that there are international priorities, policies, things that your government subscribe to that come into your support? So in activating this community, it's mainly about empowering people, indigenous peoples. If you think of forests, you need to go there and actually educate people and tell them what their participatory rights are and make sure in the NDC's formulation and implementation that marginalized groups are part of the dialogue.
Kishan?
Thank you. I think the entry point, or perhaps one of the first entry points, would have to be a recognition that the poor communities and poor populations are particularly vulnerable. That vulnerability is a function of climate change impacts that will worsen their situation. And therefore, the need for building resilience, for getting out of that vulnerable state of vulnerability is a first step. So I think the recognition that poor communities are vulnerable in the first instance is perhaps the first entry point to convince them that, look, climate change impacts are just only going to worsen your situation.
Thank you. Can we have a round of applause for the panelists? And another round of applause for the participants.